back. It's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
C-R-I-M-E-W-A-V. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit. Welcome to the Wave, people. This week, I'm happy to present Tim Malini's story, Prisoner of Love. Tim Malini is a West Coast guy. We're back to the West Coast. He's from San Francisco, like myself. He's the award-winning author of Stealing the Dragon, a novel about San Francisco's Chinatown, named a killer book by the Independent Mystery Booksellers Association, and currently being adapted for film. I would say that in terms of warnings, this is about an R-rated story. No extreme violence, swearing, or dirty stuff going on here. So feel free to have this in your ears with no fear at all. Prisoner of Love, Tim Malini.
This is Tim Malini, award-winning author of Stealing the Dragon, and I'm going to be reading a short story called Prisoner of Love. The Nimrod in the Ford Taurus forgot to roll down his window before he started shooting at me. Maybe he got confused, saw me driving right next to him, and forgot that I was the one in the convertible. His side window exploded as sparks shot across my hood. Lucky for me, not so much for him. Shards of safety glass blew back into his face, one piece catching him in the left eye. He lurched to the right instinctively, dragging the wheel with him. The car swerved into a fire hydrant, and the crumple zones in the newly redesigned Taurus folded like origami gone bad. He sailed through the windshield, bringing more safety glass with him, but unfortunately leaving his right arm behind. His gun hand was wedged inside the steering wheel, like one of those clubs designed to stop assholes from stealing your car. His arm was severed at the elbow, still holding his Beretta. His name was Stu Maloney, small-time hood and half-ass trigger man. Now Stu was an urban art exhibit, wrapped around the telephone pole on the corner of Mission and 21st. Stu had taken something that didn't belong to him. My girlfriend, Sarah. I left my car idling in the middle of the street and popped the trunk on the Taurus. Hi, honey. Sarah looked pissed. I can't say I blamed her, since she didn't even know I was in the life until Stu put a gun to her head and shoved her into his trunk. Fortunately for me, Sarah had duct tape over her mouth. She looked more scuffed than stunned. Stu had a surprisingly clean trunk. No tire irons or golf balls lying around, waiting to bash Sarah in the head whenever he took a hard left. She glared at me, which I took as a sign she hadn't suffered even a mild concussion. I smiled reassuringly and walked to the front of the car. Stu had slid to the bottom of the pole. His head was jerking back and forth as he tried to locate his missing arm. The one that was still attached dragged him pathetically along the sidewalk. It looked like his legs might be broken. I stepped over a river of blood and bent down so Stu could see my eyes. Seatbelts save lives, Stu. Stu spit safety glass before he managed to get his tongue working. Blow me, Nat. Always so original. His left arm swung around and I shuffled back a step so he couldn't reach me. I just got my slacks back from the dry cleaner. Did the old man send you? I asked. Stu gargled and something rattled around deep in his throat. Maybe it was his voice because it bubbled to the surface in a fountain of blood. You stole our loot. Our loot? I shook my head sadly. You stole my girlfriend. She's hot. Stu actually managed to smile, his pathetic teeth broken and red. I'll tell her you said so, I said. Who sent you? I need an ambulance, said Stu. He shook his head and banged his forehead on the sidewalk, leaving a red stain. I glanced at his side where his gun hand used to be. The river was flowing faster. When he looked at me again, his eyes were milky. Somewhere in the distance, I heard sirens. You don't need an ambulance, I said. Yeah, I fucking do. I shook my head and pulled the Glock from my waistband, pressed the barrel against his forehead. Stu crossed his eyes for an instant as he tried to focus on the gun, then whipsawed back to me. Was it the old man, Stu? I need an ambulance. No, you don't. I pulled the trigger. I squatted on the sidewalk, watching Stu's brains mix with the blood from his arm, the whole mess flowing off the curb into the sewer drain. My pants were still clean, but my shoes were a fucking mess. I stepped to the trunk and got Sarah into a fireman's carry without giving her an opportunity to kick me in the balls. I thought about removing the tape, but the sirens were louder now, only a few blocks away. I thumbed my remote and opened my trunk, then gently set her inside. Her eyes suggested my chances of getting laid that night were nil. I smiled apologetically and closed the lid. We'd met less than a week ago, thanks to an internet dating service, then walked around to the driver's side and slid behind the wheel, headed right down Mission, keeping my speed low, passing two cop cars coming from the opposite direction. They didn't even give me a second glance. I drove past the flower stand, thought about stopping, then changed my mind as I visualized the look on Sarah's face. Flowers weren't going to cut it this time. We'd met less than a week ago, thanks to an internet dating service. After years of fucking around, I finally took the plunge. Online harmony, the promise of a virtual match, cyber dating, whatever you want to call it. It was the last resort of a desperate man. Kind of hard to meet a nice woman in my line of work. Not that strippers aren't nice, whores aren't perfectly pleasant, or madams don't have anything interesting to say. They just weren't the right kind of girls for me to meet. I know plenty of guys smarter than me, but it didn't take an advanced degree in statistics to understand the state lottery offered better odds than trying to find my soulmate on the job. My clients were criminals, and I worked alone. I was a fixer. Something got broken, I patched it up. That broken something might be a business deal, a little misunderstanding between associates, in which case money had to change hands. Cash carried by a neutral party, which would be me. Or maybe someone forgot to pay for something. A simple oversight with dire consequences. I'd get a call to fix that situation, perhaps by strongly encouraging the negligent buyer to pay up immediately, with interest. Sometimes I delivered cash, other times equipment, and sometimes I delivered people. Sometimes the people were still breathing, other times they might be a little oxygen challenged. Either way, the problem got fixed. I was damn good at my job. Then a day before I met Sarah, something got so fucked up that even I couldn't fix it. It was a simple heist, smash and grab job. Four guys chosen to hit a jewelry store after closing, right off Union Square. The old man managed to get blueprints and bribed a disgruntled security guard to cough up the alarm code. Then the old man blackmailed a clerk with a penchant for underage trim for the combination to the safe. The old man was thorough, had to give him that. Our guys would be wearing ski masks, so that the surveillance cameras weren't a concern. My job was to provide the gear in the car. I was also the driver. I bought the ski masks from three different outdoor stores just in case somebody dropped theirs and the cops tried to trace the purchase. Flashlights, glass cutter, crowbar, a drawstring bag to hold the loot. No night vision or laser sights, no Austrian pistols, none of that shit. This was a robbery, not Mission Impossible. The other three guys were Matt, Allen, and Stu. Not the brightest beacons in the cosmos, but they were perfect for this job. Matt was a bruiser, weighing over 300 pounds, who could crack four walnuts simultaneously between his five fingers. The stunt good for getting people to buy him drinks, but not much else. Matt liked hitting things, so he was on crowbar duty for any locked display cases or uncooperative inside doors. Now, Allen was a ladies' man with a geology degree and a gambling problem. He knew the right stones to snatch, an important qualification when time isn't your friend. And even with the alarm disabled, we wanted to be in and out within minutes. The job came off as planned, in that my three colleagues managed to clear the front door, break open the safe, and fill the velvet bag with shiny rocks and assorted jewelry. I had the engine running and the trunk open when they came around the corner into the alleyway. Allen tossed me the bag and I locked it into the metal box bolted to the floor of my trunk, shut the lid without waking the neighbors, and slid behind the wheel. I felt the shocks bounce as Big Mac climbed into the back seat and shut his door. Then I pulled away from the curb and drove straight to the old man's bar. As Allen so delicately summed up the job, we were in and out, as easy as a crack whore in heat. Too bad the stones turned out to be fake. Every single one was a lump of glass or finely cast piece of plastic. Finding a cubic zirconium among the sack of shit we brought into the old man's office would have been cause for celebration. Given all the trouble he'd gone to, recruiting the jewelry store employees to his cause, it's fair to say the old man was less than thrilled. There were only two possibilities. One, the store got tipped off and made the switch. Unlikely, since the old man put the squeeze on the security guard and knew where he lived. The sales clerk was married with kids and couldn't afford the alimony, so the blackmail should have held tight. Besides, even a civilian knew the risks of crossing the old man. Option 2, an inside job. Alan had tossed me the bag, but Matt had been holding it inside the store while the other guys filled it up. And Stu, he had handled it at one point when Matt was prying open the door to the office. Each man slipped out of the store separately, so only one would get nabbed if a cop passed by. In other words, the guy who made the switch might have tossed the bag to an accomplice hiding outside. Any one of the three men who went inside could have stashed the bag of real gems near the building before I saw them come around the corner to the car. We knew something was wrong the moment the old man looked through a loop, one of those little spyglass gadgets jewelers wear. His free eye went wide with disbelief over the magnified junk his other eye was seeing. The old man told us to stay right where we were. Not that anyone had made a move from the moment he muttered, "Mother of fucking Christ." The old man got religious. You knew it was serious. Bob the bouncer went outside and searched my car. I'd given him the combination of my trunk safe, where he found my spare gun and an extra magazine. But no gems. Never had I been so happy to be the driver, the outside man on an inside job. We all sat around the table, silent as monks, as we waited for word to come back that a search of the street and sewer drains outside the jewelry store, conducted as discreetly as possible, revealed nothing but litter. We were fucked. The old man gave each of us a hard stare, his black eyes boring a hole into our skulls, his nostrils flaring like he could smell if he were lying. I studied the other guys as he interrogated each in turn, knowing this was going to be my mess to clean up later. Matt was sweating like a pig. But he was a pig, and he always sweated. No useful body language there. Alan smiled like a used car salesman, but he owned a dealership on South Van Ness, so he really couldn't help himself. And Stu kept glancing from the old man to the door, as if he had to take a piss and might let loose at any moment. I took that as a sure sign of guilt until a sharp odor hit. I saw the trickle down the inside of his right pants leg. Guess Stu couldn't hold it any longer. After the excitement of the robbery, he should have gone as soon as we hit the bar. That's what I did. I had trouble meeting the old man's eyes at first, then forced myself to swing my sockets around. I didn't want him thinking I felt guilty, so I held his black iron gaze. I hated that disappointed look he got, that how could this have happened look, that fucking look that said I had better fix this before things got really fucking bad for everyone. "How could this have happened, Nat?" he asked. His face drooped into sagging folds of dismay, like Walter Matthau in The Taking of Pelham 123, or one of those Sherpa dogs. "It's a mystery, sir," I said. I always called the old man sir. He seemed to like it. "A mystery," he nodded, then scanned the faces around the table. "You like mysteries, Nat?" I shook my head. "I'm not much of a reader, sir." He said, "Check out Cherkover. He's good." "But I digress." The old man loved to use words like digress. Sometimes I thought he actually wanted things to go sideways, just so he could work a word like ostracize or digress into one of his lectures. "Some wise guy shot you in the kneecap, the old man beat you over the head with his vocabulary." I nodded but didn't say anything. "I want you to fix this, Nat." "Quelle fucking surprise, if you'll pardon my French." But I kept that thought to myself and simply said, "Yes, sir." The old man cut us loose and I felt the weight of his hand on my shoulder as I buttoned my jacket, the pressure of his eyes on my back as I stepped outside. I had to check my rearview mirror just to make sure he wasn't sitting in the back seat, waiting for the right moment to deliver a motivational speech. "I want you to fix this. This never would have happened to me when I was 30. Middle age had hit me like a flagellant who suddenly realized it was a lot more rewarding to be a sadist than a masochist. I was on my knees, miserable and alone, with no chance of redemption. To turn this around, I needed a real woman to save my soul. As if in answer to a prayer, the very next day I met Sarah. Her email caught me by surprise because I had forgotten about my application. It had been more than 2 weeks since I sat at the bar next to Bob the bouncer, who was taking a break from the door to help me with my profile, my internet dating profile. Bob said, "You want to meet the right girl, you have to tell her the truth." He gave me an earnest look. Bob had been married for 14 years. I gave him a look of my own. "After I meet the right girl, then maybe I'll tell her the truth. How many dates do you think I'll get, Bob, if my profile says I work for the mob?" Bob shrugged. "Say you work in a family business." "It asks how much money I make." Bob raised an eyebrow. "How much does the old man pay you? None of your fucking business." "Okay," said Bob. "Pick a number high enough to afford a nice car. That's important to girls. But not so high you sound like a blue blood." "Got it. Okay. How about this next one? What do I like to do more, walk on the beach barefoot or curl up on the couch with a blanket and a good book?" Bob gave me a funny look. "The fuck should I know?" And so it went. Bob was a surprisingly good sounding board, even if some of his suggestions lacked a certain romantic appeal. I did my best to paint a self-portrait that bore an uncanny resemblance to me, or at least a version of me that didn't break the law for a living. Then I went back to work and forgot all about the application. Sarah's email was short but witty, plenty of attitude and very few words. I knew right away I wanted to meet her. I must have edited my reply a dozen times before I hit send. We emailed back and forth the next day. It was a nice distraction from my troubles, especially since I decided not to do anything at all about the foiled heist for at least 24 hours. Because if it was an inside job, then one of our guys would be sitting at home right now waiting for the knock on the door, unless he was stupid enough to bolt. And whoever he was, I wanted him sleep-deprived, jumpy, and scared, his confession written in the stains beneath his arms and the sweat on his upper lip. I wanted him to do something stupid and make my job easier. Because I was, by nature, a lazy fuck. The next day, Sarah and I agreed to meet at a coffee shop. In person, she didn't disappoint. Like her emails, she could be described with very few words. Short, plenty of attitude, and beautifully put together. Somehow I managed not to screw it up. I had memorized my profile before I left my apartment. By the time we finished our coffee, I almost believed I was the guy she was obviously attracted to. I kind of felt like Bruce Wayne. I invited her to dinner. Then we exchanged numbers and said our goodbyes, a lingering handshake that morphed into a tentative hug. That night I got a call and answered before checking caller ID, hoping it was her, but the old man's voice was a golden shower of reality. "Big Matt is no longer with us," he said. The old man wasn't much for preamble. "Where?" I asked. "He's at home." The old man hung up. Guess he wasn't in the mood for one of his lectures. But I digress. The first question a professional asks isn't how someone got killed, it's where, because that tells you what kind of hit went down. Someone dies of natural causes, you read about it in the paper, or the person calling you spells it out, without fear of the feds taping the conversation. But when someone dies of unnatural causes, the where can tell you a lot more than the how. Say you kill a guy in public or dump his body where it will be easily found. Then you're making a statement. Odds are a rival family or the competition are making some kind of move. If a guy disappears, it could be he ran. Witness protection, or maybe running from the feds to avoid facing the horrible choice of turning states or getting taken out by one of your own. But if someone gets killed at home where they live and sleep, then it's personal, especially if they have a family. Then it's probably an inside job. So this tragic turn of events suggested Big Matt may have been the culprit in our little caper, and he had a partner. As I dressed for dinner, I wondered if the partner was inside or outside our little circle of friends. Sarah wore an LBD, that's a little black dress, that was made from some test fabric developed by NASA to bond with every curve, slope, and molecule of her body. I was in orbit by the time we ordered dessert, dizzy from lack of oxygen, because I was holding my breath every time she leaned forward, touched her hair, or rested her hand on the table next to mine. I was falling hard enough to ignore the gravity of my situation. I kissed her goodnight, a long, lingering kiss that promised our next dinner might turn into breakfast. And I forgot all about stolen jewels, Big Matt, and my alter ego until I got home. My phone started ringing as I turned my key in the door. The old man's voice was all too familiar. "Alan is no longer with us," he said. "Where?" I asked. The old man hung up without bothering to answer. I bit my lower lip as I tried to think, but I tasted Sarah and got distracted. I poured myself a drink and breathed through my nose. Alan had fit the profile. He had a gambling problem, soft touch for the ladies, fast fingers, and loose moral fiber. He was also smarter than Matt, which meant he could have masterminded the scheme and then offered the big guy a cut. But with Alan out of the picture, things got complicated. I wasn't just getting old, I was getting slow. Here I was sitting on my hands, supposedly waiting for the inside man to panic and run. But what if the double cross was really a triple cross? What if all three guys were in cahoots? Even though it was just a passing thought, using the word cahoots in a sentence gave me chills. Maybe it was time to visit Stu. The next morning I drank enough coffee to get my teeth vibrating. Then I drove over to Stu's place and waited outside. His car wasn't in the driveway, and he didn't come outside to fetch the paper. By noon I was starving and antsy, so I drove to a nearby diner and ordered a club sandwich and a bowl of carrots. I liked eating carrots when I was trying to figure something out. It made me feel smart, like Bugs Bunny. The bowl of carrots was almost empty when I realized what was up. Stu had a fuse shorter than an Irishman's pecker. He He wasn't likely to wait around for someone to ring his doorbell and then shoot him in the face. If he thought one of the other guys stole the gems, he would just take matters into his own hands and shoot the thieving bastard, score points with the old man. And if Stu thought one of us was going to do the same to him, he'd shoot first and not even bother to ask questions later. 2 days was an eternity to a guy like Stu. I had underestimated his instinct for survival, always a mistake with a sociopath. I finished my carrots and decided there was only one thing I could do. I avoided the whole situation and called Sarah and invited her out to dinner. She agreed to meet me at the restaurant at 6. By the time I slipped my phone into my pocket, my pulse had quickened. I could hear my heart pounding in my ears, the drumbeat of love drowning out any voice of reason. Dinner was perfect. Not rushed, but not too drawn out either. I forced myself to eat slowly. And even though I was already thinking ahead to driving her home, I can't remember what we talked about, but I can still hear the sound of her voice. Then that cocksucker Stu interrupted dessert, stole Sarah, and ruined any shot I might have had at getting laid that night. Now I was laying Sarah gently on my bed. Stu, a distant memory, a bloody pulp on the sidewalk. Sarah's eyes shooting laser beams of anger at my face. I forced a smile and tore the duct tape off as decisively as I could. As Sarah spit fibers from her lips, I yanked her clutch purse from my jacket pocket and tossed it onto the bed. It was surprisingly heavy. Her cell phone bounced out of the purse and landed a foot away near the headboard. I must say I was impressed and vaguely horrified that Sarah had managed to grab the purse while being abducted by Stu. If a woman had that kind of reflexes when it came to accessories, what was she like when it came to buying shoes? I kept the thought to myself and squared my feet on the rug, bracing myself for the verbal onslaught that was sure to come. Once Sarah plucked the last strand of tape from her lower lip, she looked mad and sexy as hell. "You lied to me," she said. She sounded more hurt than pissed, and I leaned forward to give her a hug and caught myself when I met her gaze. Her measured tone belied the simmering anger lurking in her bottomless brown eyes. "You said you were a claims adjuster," she said. "Well," I began. "Shut up!" She shifted on the bed, got her legs underneath her. They looked great, no stockings, the only visible veins, the one pulsing on either side of her neck. I dragged my eyes away from her legs and tried to look contrite as she added, "Just shut up, Nat." "Okay," I said. She sighed. "Why do I always attract the pathological liars?" Was that a rhetorical question, sweetie? Didn't I just tell you to shut up?" she said. I didn't know how to answer that one. "Fuck me," she sighed loudly. Before I could ask if that was an invitation to kiss and make up, or her own version of a rhetorical question, she stood abruptly and grabbed her purse. She pointed at the door. "Is that the bathroom?" I nodded, still waiting for permission to speak. Sarah gave me a hard look and then grabbed my hair with her free hand and pulled me forward to give me an even harder kiss. "Asshole," she said, but the way she said it, I knew she was in love with me, too. Sarah disappeared down the hall and I heard the bathroom door close just as her cell phone started to ring. I ignored it at first and sat down heavily on the bed, right next to the phone, a knot in my chest slowly unraveling. But then the phone bounced against my thigh, and I glanced down. I recognized the number. I stared at the number for a full minute, the little phone trilling like a baby bird. Then I pulled my own phone from my pocket and quickly thumbed through my address book. The same number that was flashing on Sarah's caller ID appeared on the screen of my phone next to a name I had known for over 20 years. It was a name I never used anymore, because it was so much easier just to call him the old man. I felt a knot in my chest being retied by a compulsive sailor and had to force myself to take a breath. Down the hall, I heard the sound of a toilet flushing behind a closed door. There wasn't much time. I thought about how I'd gotten myself into this situation. The old man didn't find the false bottom in my car safe, but he must have had his suspicions. Bob the bouncer had helped me with my application for internet dating, so maybe that's where Sarah came from. I always was an outsider, and none of us was getting any younger. I was through fixing things for other people. I was through working for the old man. I just needed one last job to put everything in motion, distract the old man long enough for things to fix themselves. Stu had been the perfect wind-up toy, a sociopath who would go berserk, take out the other guys before anyone could find a trail. But I was the one who got distracted. I hadn't counted on Sarah. Had she been instructed to get close enough to find the gems? Was she just bait for Stu? Was she supposed to finish the job he started? I thought about the taste of her kiss, the adhesive from the tape pulling our lips apart with a painful tug. I thought about the weight of her purse and wondered what could be heavier than a cell phone. I pulled my gun from my waistband and hefted it in my hand, already knowing the answer. I heard her footsteps on the carpeting in the hallway. I was a prisoner of love, and there were only two ways to escape. The only question now was which one of us held the key.
Yes, that was The Prisoner of Love by Tim Maleeny, and I hope you enjoyed it. Please leave information for us at crimewave.com. Join the site, get involved in the forums, start spreading the love of crime over here at crimewave.com.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word. Register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email, and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave.
Here's a song to the store, but the shape of a snake and a smile that went along with that.